I think just regular bugling is not terribly hard to do, but you know, chuckling and grunting and those kind of sounds take a lot more practice. They really do. And you know, it seems like you can practice and practice, and then all of a sudden you'll just have kind of what I call a breakthrough. All of a sudden you'll just go, wow, that's it right there. You know, that's kind of hit it right there. As far as the bulls bugling on their own and being responsive to calls, it doesn't necessarily matter how good I sound or necessarily, you know, what I'm throwing out there as far as calls. I've learned more and more that for the rut to kick in, it's all about the cows, and it revolves around them and what's going on with them and the estrus cycle. Because I found that when they're bugling on their own, mm-hmm. and you don't have to yank a courtesy bugle out of them, that's when they're more responsive to your calling and are going to come into calls. The closer you can be and the more convenient and the less he has to, you know, lose the wind to his advantage and just can come take a quick look, the more apt he is to come in and check you out that way. It's always hard if you're sitting water to know whether to, you know, let nature be nature, I call it, mm-hmm. and just don't insert yourself into the equation at all and just let it play out how it would naturally play out. A lot of times I'm inclined to do that. I don't know, maybe it's just a little bit of hunter instinct that you have to use and determine whether or not you feel like it's right or whether it could potentially mess things up.
Welcome to Days in the Wild Big Game Hunting Podcast, brought to you by Phoenix Shooting Bags. A couple things before we jump into this episode. Please, you heard me say a million times, go give us a review on iTunes. Helps me keep this podcast free and helps with the ratings. Also, go check out Phoenix Shooting Bags. If you use our promo code John Stallone, all one word, you save 20% off on anything. And it's not just shooting bags. They do glassing pads. They're working on some other really cool stuff coming up here for the hunter, bow hunters also. So go check them out, phoenixshootingbags.com. And if you're looking for a really good hunt, I have some really good opportunities for you. Hit us up on daysinthewild.com or check out my blog, johnstallone.me, and send us an email. If you're looking to do a coos deer hunt, javelina, mule deer in South Dakota, we got some opportunities in California as well. So give me a call if you're looking to do something different this year and like to get on a special hunt, Days in the Wild Outfitters, and we'll take care of you. Without further ado, let's jump into this episode. Hi, welcome to Days in the Wild Big Game Hunting Podcast, brought to you by Phoenix Shooting Bags. Today, we're going to continue with the Lessons Learned series, and I got my friend Steve Chappell on with us, and we're going to talk a little elk. What's going on, Steve?
Hey, John. It's going good. It's getting closer to September, and I can't wait for bugle and bulls. I'm expecting some good weather and a change in the drought here pretty soon, and I'll tell you, I can't wait for September, man.
Yeah, it's coming up hot. You know, here we are. It's going to be July 1st, what, tomorrow, yeah?
Yep, that's exactly it.
Yeah, so it doesn't – I'm fortunate enough that I got two hunts before any of my elk hunts. For myself personally, I'm going blacktail hunting in a couple of weeks, and then I'll hunt deer here in August, but which I might not do. I don't know yet. I'm kind of wavering back and forth. If the conditions don't get better, I might not do it. Not because I don't think I could get a deer. In fact, you have a better chance of getting a deer if it stays droughty, you know, obviously hunting water and whatever. But I just don't want to be the guy to take another deer out of the herd that's hurting, you know?
Exactly.
I don't think a lot of people are thinking about that. So...
Yeah, it's definitely dry out there, and the animals are – it's going to get to be a real dire situation if we don't get some rain soon. So I'm kind of liking the, you know, this cloudiness we're getting and this chance for monsoon storms in the afternoon, and I really, really hope it happens soon.
Yeah. Yeah, it needs to. The deer herd's hurting. The elk herd, I don't think, is not as affected. And most of the stuff up north is not nearly as bad. But all this desert stuff is bad. I mean, we took 23 deer out of the desert last year. And it's just, if you have another couple more years like that, they're going to be hurting bad. They're going to start. I mean, look at all the closures that they've already done with the archery and all that stuff. So people are going to not have that opportunity to hunt anymore. They don't start thinking about things to maybe help the deer out a little bit here.
You know? Exactly. So,
So I explained to you the lessons learned that we kind of share with us some stories that have maybe had teaching moments, or when you figured out something about hunting elk, or, you know, maybe change the way you hunt, any of that kind of stuff. So the floor is yours.
Yeah, John, I can, you know, really think of some specific things that really changed my thought process with how I go about elk hunting. And, you know, for me, calling is kind of where it starts and ends with elk hunting. So I'm going to kind of talk about that and some different things that I've learned as far as calling goes. And I would say the biggest thing for me, you know, that really changed my thought process was, I'm going to say it started back around about 2015, 2016. You know, up until that point, you and I have visited about this before, I had pretty much been a cow caller my whole career. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I'm not going to say that I've completely shifted to being a bugler, because that's not the case at all. But I would say that back then in around 2016, 2017, because of some encounters that I had with some particular bulls, I shifted and had to basically bugle at them and make bull sounds at them to get them to come in. They weren't going to come into cow calling because they were herd bulls. And, you know, in my career, most of the bulls I was calling in were satellite bulls, of course, because, you know, they're alone. They're looking for company. Mm-hmm. They're ripe for the picking, I always say. But I can remember this, you know, in particular, this hunt I had with John Holzhieder in 2016. And we'd called some bulls in during the hunt, but we hadn't killed a bull yet. We got down to the evening of day 13. So we were in the bottom of the night, so to speak. And the bugling during the whole hunt was really hit and miss and mostly off. So it was a very tough hunt. And finally that afternoon, late that afternoon, I got a bull to sound off to me. I think I cow called to get him to sound off to me. And then we moved in and got within, I'm going to say 120 yards of him, mm-hmm. and got set up, got John set up, and got the cameraman there with him. And I dropped back behind and started calling. And just like a lot of the bulls had done on that hunt, this bull initially was bugling and then he lost interest and didn't come in. And it was kind of almost that, you know, what go for broke, what do I have to lose scenario, if you know what I mean, John. Mm-hmm. So I decided, okay, it's proven that he's not going to come into a cow call, so I really have nothing to lose. So I just threw in a high-pitched, strong bugle at that bull. And he was literally walking away and leaving. And when I did that bugle, he immediately turned, bugled hard, and came walking right back in. And John got about a 30-yard shot at him, mm-hmm. and killed him. And that really just changed my mindset right there. And John's wife, Sally, had the early rifle tag that same year. So we started hunting, you know, day one with her. And by day five, again, we'd had a lot of encounters, called in quite a few bulls, again, mostly with cow calling. But then on the morning of day four, I believe it was, I had another encounter with a herd bull. And again, he would bugle at the cow calling, but he was keeping his distance. And when I threw in, you know, what I call a lip ball bugle, some people call it a display bugle. It's kind of that sputtery mm-hmm. sound that you make by vibrating your lips. Amazingly, one of the cows broke loose and came right in first. And she kind of checked things out and got a little bit spooky and kind of boogered off. And I thought, well, it's over with. But I bugled a couple of more times, and lo and behold, the rest of the herd came in, including the bull. And he came up to about 30 yards. And we were in an area, John, where we were anticipating about a 300-yard shot
right.
across a pretty good-sized draw. And so we had Sally laying down in the prone position. And when that bull came up to 30 yards, she just could not get shifted around and get a shot at the bull. So we literally had to wait, and they were probably around 3 to 5 minutes, the elk were, before they kind of figured out something was wrong, and they spooked, and I stopped him with a bugle, and she got a shot at about 120 yards, and then another follow-up shot at about 275 and put him down.
I actually watched that hunt on YouTube. I remember watching that hunt now.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. So I'm it's very easy for me to picture everything that you're saying right now. Yeah. That was a great hunt. Go ahead. Sorry.
Right. Oh, no worries. Yeah. I'm glad you got to see that. So, you know, I'm not telling a guide story, right? Anyway. Yeah. Again, just, you know, within, you know, less than a 1 week period, those were two herd bulls that I had to deal with differently than many elk I had in the past. So, you know, I realized right then that rather than, you know, kind of having this approach of taking my game to the field and throwing my game at every elk, that, you know, I was going to take the kind of the open mindset and go at it with, well, each elk and each scenario is a little bit different, and I need to adjust and adjust my calling for that. And, you know, kind of what it made me do, John, is it made me stretch myself as far as my calling. It made me, you know, spend some more time practicing bugling in the off season than I had in the past. Because with it not being that important to me prior to that, or so I thought, I didn't spend as much time, you know, learning it and mastering it. Because, I mean, let's be honest, I think just regular bugling is not terribly hard to do, but, you know, chuckling and grunting and those kind of sounds take a lot more practice. They really do. And, you know, it seems like you can practice, and then all of a sudden you'll just have kind of what I call a breakthrough all of a sudden. You'll just go, wow, that's it right there. You know, that's I kind of hit it right there. And I think for me, it's not only listening to good callers, like, you know, if someone can chuckle well, I'll listen to them and try to learn off of that. But then mainly listening to elk,
right?
And patterning your calling and practice time, and listening to live elk as much as you can. Really helps. So that was a big breakthrough for me, the bugling, and, you know, and learning that bugling opens up just a lot more opportunity. You know, kind of the same thing happened the next year on the archery hunt. I was hunting with a guy named Mark Long, super cool guy. We got down to the morning of day 10. Again, we had had a lot of encounters on the hunt, but just hadn't taken a bull. And, you know, again, down to the end of the hunt, and we encountered a bull with some cows, and same deal. I bugled to locate him, and he bugled back at me. And then as we moved in and I was trying cow calling, he got quiet on me. So it was that no lose situation again. So I just moved in tight on him, actually saw one of his cows. And so we set up right there with that cow nearby, and he bugled and chuckled, and I chuckled back at him. And then we got set up, and he bugled again, and I bugled a real aggressive lip ball at him, and he came right in with his ears pinned back, kind of like you see a whitetail doing that kind of parallel march looking posture. Right. Yeah, he had one of his ears pinned back. You could tell he was just agitated, and walked right up to about 35 yards, and Mark stuck it on him. So it was a great capper, great ending to, you know, a really exciting hunt. But again, proved to me that, you know, in certain situations that the bugling can really pay off. So, you know, that was another great experience as far as the bugling goes. I would say, John, another thing that I've learned over the years, and I'm reminded every single year when I try to forget it, is that as far as the bulls bugling on their own and being responsive to calls, it doesn't necessarily matter how good I sound, or necessarily, you know, what I'm throwing out there as far as calls. I've learned more and more that for the rut to kick in, it's all about the cows, and it revolves around them and what's going on with them and the estrus cycle, you know,
right.
Yep. With them. So if we have a year like 2020, which was bad in many ways, as we all know, but it was also rough in the elk woods for a lot of us, including me. And that was because we had this extended drought that we're still in. You know, it had started last spring of 2020, and it continued clear into the fall.
Right.
And, you know, for me, I don't know about for you, John, but the bulls were barely bugling at all.
It was terrible.
Yeah. And when it's that way, I found that you know, if they're just a tiny bit vocal and you go in and put pressure on them and call at them, typically they just shut down and move away from you.
Right.
And that's what I was finding over and over. So, you know, I was just reminded once again that it's not necessarily about me and what I'm doing. It's about those cows, and we really need good range conditions out there, good green up, you know, in the summer and early fall, so that these elk are healthy and those cows ester cycle normally, and those bulls bugle. Because I found that when they're bugling on their own, mm-hmm. and you don't have to yank a courtesy bugle out of them, that's when they're more responsive to your calling and are going to come into calls.
Right. And yeah, so, I mean, of course, if you don't, the other thing is, you know, if you don't have to alert them that there's another bull in the area or another cow in the area, and you can just keep slipping in if they're bugling on their own. And then once you're, you know, in that sweet spot or whatever, then you hit them. That's always more effective.
Yes. Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. You know, and kind of going along with that, that it's all about the cows. I'm always reminded that sometimes it's easy to call bulls in, you know, certain bulls are easy to call in, and you say to yourself, wow, that was easy. But most of the time, I would say most of the time, I'm always reminded again every fall of how it's not easy and how you have to do things right. You know, you yeah. have to obviously play the wind all the time. I think no matter how particular a guy is or gal is about their scent, it's always about the wind, and you have to have that right. And if you're calling to a bull and you make it easy for him to slip downwind and get your wind, he's going to do that every time before he comes into a call. So I really try to get that wind right in my face, or, you know, really angling to me so that he's got to literally walk around me to get my wind. Because that's one thing I've learned. If you give them that wind, they're going to take it every time. And you'll never see them. They'll slip downwind on you, and then all of a sudden they just aren't bugling anymore, and they just disappear.
Do also, you have a preferred wind direction? Like, you know, I don't mean like north, south. I mean in right. relation to you. Between you and the bull, how would you like to see the wind? What have you found works the best? Because you know they're going to circle to come get the wind.
Yeah. You know, John, I wouldn't say that I've analyzed it that much other than to say that I definitely like it either straight in my face, or if I can't get it straight in my face, you know, I like it maybe at the most, maybe at a 45 to me, at a minimum. What else I've noticed with wind is obviously it's out of the norm for a bull to come into you and lose the wind, so to speak, lose the wind to his advantage. So he's not as apt to come in when he doesn't have the wind. So I found that getting close to him makes it better. Mm-hmm. So rather than trying to call him in and make him lose the wind for 300 or 400 yards, if you can get inside of, I've kind of found that magic zone to be like 120 or 100 if I can get there mm-hmm. without spooking. The closer you can be and the more convenient and the less he has to, you know, lose the wind to his advantage and just can come take a quick look, the more apt he is to come in and check you out that way.
Right.
So that's the biggest thing I've learned about the wind. I've maybe told this story before, so I apologize if I have, but my wind checker is so important to me that if I don't have it, I just absolutely feel like I can't really hunt effectively. Mm-hmm. Because, you know, it's not always just a stiff wind direction. There's thermals out there that can hardly detect. One time I forgot my wind checker at camp, and we got down the road, I don't know, maybe 3 to 5 minutes down the road. And for some reason, I realized that I'd forgotten my wind checker. And unfortunately, I was driving and I started reaching around, checking for my wind checker to see if it was in my truck. And I got distracted enough that I literally drove us off the road and down into the bar ditch. And Johnny, it was steep enough where I went off the road that there was a culvert there. And luckily, I didn't roll the truck. You know, when I realized I was going off the road, I didn't overreact and try to pull it back on the road. I just kind of went with it and just went down into the bar ditch and bumped around a little bit, drove back up on the road. And I tell you what, my hunter looked at me like, are you trying to kill us? Oh yeah. He was white as he could be. And I said, you know, I forgot my wind checker. So, yeah, we went back and got my wind checker and went out and hunted. So anyway, guys, don't leave your wind checker behind. Don't kill yourself if you do.
Yeah. So we've all done stuff like that before.
Yeah. Yeah. So, you know, moving on to a different topic as far as something I've learned, John, I would say, you know, and I wouldn't say I do this a lot, but sometimes I've learned that non-vocal sounds work better than vocal sounds. What I mean by that is sometimes not cow calling, not bugling is better, and using sounds like raking, huffing. You know, I shouldn't say glunking because that's a vocal sound, but that's a little different sound, if you know what I mean, than just bugling or cow calling. It's different. I've called bulls in with that again, wouldn't come into, you know, any type of call that I threw at them. Maybe I was trying to call them in with a mouth diaphragm, cow calling. I switched to an open read call. Maybe he bugles a couple of times at the open read call and gets a little closer, but then hangs up again. I can remember one bull in particular with Mark Long that I ended up calling on in. It was Tim Sightseer, actually, that I was hunting with. I ended up calling that bull on in by adding glunking in there. Mm-hmm. A bull in 2015 that I can specifically think of that had cows. You know, again, I threw everything at him that I could think to throw at him. And when I stopped making vocal sounds and got back there and started raking, and I was just kind of making a huffing sound through my grunt tube, in addition to that, and that bull broke away from the cows. He didn't bugle, but he came marching right in and came up to about 30 yards from my hunter.
Yeah.
So that was kind of a big lesson learned for me. I'm kind of one of these guys that always, you know, wants to make things happen with my calling. And sometimes it's hard for me to, you know, take that different mindset and say, well, maybe what you're doing is not working. You need to rethink this a little bit and you know, and try some other things and other approaches. So, you know, I like to say, John, that I've never arrived as far as calling and elk hunting goes. I've never gotten there, so to speak. I feel like if I go to the woods every year looking to learn, that there's opportunity to learn every single year and sometimes every day, if you know what I mean.
Yeah.
Just when you think you've got it handled, these elk will school you for sure.
Oh, without a doubt.
Yeah.
Kind of going on the lines of what you were just talking about. So I made a realization with whitetail years ago and calling in whitetail, and then again with calling in coyotes. And then I started applying that to my elk hunting later on. It was just like what you were saying, but my viewpoint on it was, it's not that they didn't like the other sounds, like, and this is a sound that they want to come to. It's creating the whole illusion because, so what I found, like back in the day, like trying to rattle in a buck, you know, they hear the horns going, but then they don't hear leaves like smashing around. They don't hear sticks breaking.
Exactly.
They don't hear grunting. They don't hear the other stuff that they heard that they know they should be hearing with the sounds of the horns.
Exactly.
And so it just starts coming like, what should, you know, I try to put myself in the shoes of whatever it is that I'm hunting. So in this case, a bull, what should a bull be hearing? Whatever distance he's at. Now, you know, when you're out a couple hundred yards, he's probably not going to hear the footsteps to the other stuff, but he will hear a bugle, you know? So,
right.
But once you're into a certain distance, if he's not hearing, you know, cows feeding this, that, you know, like, or another, the bull that you're pretending to be not displaying to the cows that you supposedly have, you know, like all these things, like, if they're not there, you're not completing the picture.
Yes.
And a lot of times you're creating a situation where the elk is going to be skeptical. That's the way I view it. That's the way I view it. I'm not saying this is the truth, or, you know, but this is how I view it. With coyote calling, this is a good story, but obviously it doesn't relate to elk hunting because it's not elk hunting, but it's the whole idea of calling. And during the breeding season for coyotes, it's really tough to call them in, in my opinion here, because their minds are on other things. They're not, it's really tough to call them in with a prey sounds, you know?
Yeah.
So, I'm not going to go through what I did, all the stuff that I did, but just, I'm going to tell you about the closing thing. So I created this situation where it was a, I'm going to paint the picture for you. It was a lone, female coyote howling. Then the lone female coyote howling went to whimpering, then went to a coyote distress sound. Coyotes come running in, and then they hung up, right? And they're barking.
Yep.
Two males barking from a distance. But I knew they were within, you know, less than 100 yards. Actually, I could see one pacing back and forth. And all I did was I switched to a male growling and kind of a whimpering sound of a female on my collar. And man, all of them just, boom, they came running in. We had three of them on top of us. And my hunter shot two of them.
That's awesome.
Yeah. So it's like, they're hanging up there because they're like, oh, I don't know. This sounds right, but there's something, like, you know, not right.
Missing.
There's something missing, right? And then I gave them what was missing, and sure as shit, they came in. Like anybody else would have, I'm not going to say anybody else, but most of the time in years past, I myself would have been like, oh shit, that's it. We're done. They're not coming in. And,
right.
You know, no. And this is not going to happen. They're just going to sit back there. I mean, I can't tell you how many times I was there with, because I bow hunt them, you know, and I have coyote 100 yards away just sitting there barking and yipping and alarm barking at me or whatever. And he won't, you know, close the distance for me. And then when I made that realization several years ago that, oh, you know what, wow, you do this with whitetail. Why don't you do this with coyotes? And then again, I was like, oh, I realized it like 4 or 5 years ago with elk. I'm like, well, it's the same thing. It's the same thing. They're an animal coming to a call. They're expecting to see a certain amount of things. They're expecting to hear a certain amount of things or smell something. And you're not giving them that. Obviously, we can't give them the smell. You know, exactly. So you got to give them the sight and sound. So, you know, decoys, whatever, you know, whatever it is, you got to create the illusion. And I feel like that in itself is really like changed the way I do things. And I think you're doing the same thing now, but like, I just realized it from a different, you know, pair of lenses of looking at it differently. But yeah, it just don't get caught up on, oh, he doesn't like the way I'm bugling. He doesn't like the way I'm cow calling, whatever. It's not necessarily that. It's one, it may not be what he wants to hear for the moment. And two, you're not giving him the whole show. You know, you're not showing him everything. But
anyway. Exactly. You just reminded me, John. I'm thinking back to a time when you were talking about switching that sound on those coyotes. I had a bull hung up on me, and he was just over this little roll in the terrain to where I couldn't see him. I mean, he was probably 50 or 60 yards away, but I couldn't see him. Mm. And it was so quiet that, to be honest with you, I kind of had a lump in my throat at that point. And I was thinking, man, if I blow a call, it's probably going to sound wrong or too loud or whatnot. I had my video camera. I was down on my rear end with my video camera, like my elbows on my knees, and I had my video camera there. I literally reached down with one of my hands and started pulling grass as if it was making an elk eating grass sound.
Yes.
And it was quiet enough that bull heard that, and he came right up and got right in my lap. And I got some incredible footage of it right there. So
that's awesome.
Again, using something, you know, different than you would normally think in a non-vocal sound, you made all the difference on that particular elk. And I think had I blown a call at him as kind of keyed up and nervous as I felt in the moment, I don't think it would have come out right.
Right. Yeah. No, you know, that's huge. And again, I'm going to solidify what you just said with a whitetail thing. So years and years ago, I want to say like 20 years ago, they came out with some like call that made the sound of a deer eating acorns. And another one was like a little bag, like it was kind of like a rattle bag, but it was leaves in the bag, or it sounded like leaves in a bag.
Wow.
And, you know, guys were using these things. I think they've kind of were written off as novelty, but they were very, I've tried both of them and they worked really well. So you telling me that, and it's funny what you were saying it, because in my head, that's what I was thinking you were going to say, was that you started pulling up grass. Cause I've heard another person tell me that they've done something like that too. But yeah. That just solidifies what we were just talking about. It's like, there's other things that an elk or whatever it is that you're hunting needs to hear to verify with his ears, because he can't see it and he can't smell it, that, yeah, that's in fact what it is I think it is, you know?
Yeah.
So.
Oh, yeah. And I think especially as we, during a hunting season, as we get further into a hunt and they've potentially been called at and messed with, and they've come in and had a bad encounter coming into a call, they can get more and more leery about it. So throwing in those other non-vocal cues to them can definitely be the difference maker for sure.
Mm-hmm.
Yep.
Yep. Absolutely. Absolutely.
You know, another thing I've learned, John, is if you're near water for whatever reason, you know, if you're sitting water, or maybe you're, you know, hunting elk in places where there's wallows and springs and things like that, I found that you can, you know, take a stick and simulate a bull or a cow splashing around in the water, and, you know, just kind of slinging mud around, splashing the water. If there's elk nearby, a lot of times they'll come running into that.
Right. Yeah, I can remember a few years back, my nephew, I think it was, sorry, right when he turned 16 or he was either 15 or 16. He drew a late rifle tag, and we were up on this point and we were overlooking, we had a water hole about 400 or 500 yards from us. And I can't tell you how many times, you know, groups of elk would come into this water hole and they'd be splashing and frolicking, especially the little guys, you know, they're playing, jumping around like they're at a pool party. And and I started thinking about that, and I'm like, yeah, you know, that's that. I guess I never really sat water for elk that much, so I didn't, I guess I never put that two and two together that that happens, but I had seen it on, you know, trail cam videos and whatever. And I just, but sitting there looking at that, and I'm like, wow, that, now hearing you say that, that makes a good, makes perfect sense. You know, if you're bugling and splashing water down there, or cow calling and splashing water down there, just makes, again, back to what we're saying, is more of the illusion, giving them more pieces of the puzzle.
Yeah, exactly. It's always hard if you're sitting water to know whether to, you know, let nature be nature, I call it, mm-hmm. and just don't insert yourself into the equation at all and just let it play out how it would naturally play out. A lot of times I'm inclined to do that. I don't know, maybe it's just a little bit of hunter instinct that you have to use and determine whether or not you feel like it's right, or whether it could potentially mess things up if you were to, you know, go down and start splashing in the water or whatnot. I just think a lot of times, and just like with calling, you just kind of have to go with your gut instinct, and, you know, sometimes it's right and sometimes it's not, but, you know, you're going to learn a lesson every time. And I think that's how I've improved myself, and anyone would improve themselves, is just looking to learn from, you know, every single encounter that you have. And I think we learn more from the times it doesn't work out. You know what I mean?
Exactly.
Because, you know, okay, that didn't work, so time to try something different. But I still think overall, you know, that there's rules about elk hunting and elk calling, and, you know, we've kind of alluded to them, you know, number one being the wind, and, you know, number two, using the terrain to get as close as you can, because distance means a lot, and the easier you make it for them to come to you, you know, the more elk you're going to call in. So, you know, there's rules like that that I feel like always hold fast and true. But then again, each time you deal with an elk, and the scenario can be different, whether he's got cows or not, you know, whether there's a satellite bull nearby pestering him, you know, there's just all these variables that come into each equation, and you know, you kind of have to deal with each one individually in that manner.
Oh yeah.
Yeah.
100%. Cool. Do you got any other stories you want to share with us, or?
You know, John, I think the only other one that I can think of is the first time that I heard elk making that sound that I call the Ester scream. Now, it's debatable whether it's a true Ester sound and what it really means, but there's no doubt about it. It's a very unique sound that if you've never heard it before, the first time you do hear it, you're taken aback. I mean, it doesn't even really sound elk-like when they do it really aggressive. I can still remember, I would say now it's probably been maybe 20 years or so when I first heard it. And I came back to camp and I was literally telling the guys and my dad, I said, if those elk hadn't been right in front of me where I could visually see them making this sound, I wouldn't have believed that it was elk. Because to me, John, it sounded like, I've described it this way before, it sounded like a monkey in a cage, aggravated, just like screaming real harshly, you know, loud, real raspy sounding. Yeah, it just didn't sound elk-like to me. So, you know, after that encounter and hearing them do that for the next few years, I kind of set about trying to figure out how I could make that sound. I never really have been able to figure out how to make it on an open read call. I think it's very hard to do it on an open read. But with a mouth read, I started out using my lips and vibrating them, kind of similar to how I would lip ball bugle. You know, very similar to that. But then I've kind of moved forward and I do it now more with my throat and vibrating my vocal cords as I'm blowing a call. And again, it's not a sound that I just go out and use indiscriminately, no doubt, because it's a super aggressive call. I'm still hesitant to use it. Again, usually it's a call that I use when I feel like I have nothing else to lose or nothing else to try. So my hunter can't say that I messed anything up, if you know what I mean, John. You being a guide as well. But it's amazing to me, especially I've used it on evening hunts where the bulls aren't bugling, nothing I try as you know, sunset comes on and nothing's calling. And I'll just tell my hunter, hey, we're just going to start walking along and trolling and I'm going to blow this call and please don't look at me funny. Exactly. That's it. And I kind of like to say I do it every time my left foot hits the ground is the frequency I'm doing it with. And it's incredible how it can go from the woods being totally quiet to all of a sudden you wake a bull up and start walking to him. And if I get a bull woke up and he's bugling, I just start walking at him and I continually make that call. What I found is that if I stop and set up and try to call him in and continue to make the sound, they don't like it. They like me to keep coming at them, making that sound. And I'll literally walk right up until I think it's going to be an absolute collision train wreck type of scenario. And that's when we'll drop down real quick. You know, just so the bull doesn't get a visual of us walking right up. And generally they'll come in on the tear. Sometimes two or three bulls will come in to that. So, you know, that was a big breakthrough for me as well in my calling. Again, something that I don't use every time or with every hunter, but again, if I just kind of instinctually think, okay, it's the time, now's the time to try it. I'll do it. And, you know, many times it'll work. So,
yeah. One of my other guests talked about that quite a bit. It was very, very along the same lines as you. And the way that it was described to me was because it's an excited, demanding call.
Yeah.
And, it's usually it's when a cow's, I guess, demanding that the bull come and that.
Yeah.
And so it's coming towards and, you know, going towards the bull and wants the bull to come towards them. And that makes sense because it's basically the exact same, you know, scenario that you said it works for you and works. I haven't personally used it. I made that sound in the woods before, but I haven't done it the way you described it or he did yet. I'm going to definitely try that out the next time I'm in a situation where I don't feel like what I'm doing is working.
But, yeah, absolutely. It sounds like you can do it too, John, from what I just heard there.
It takes me one or two to do it though. That's the problem. Like, it doesn't come out of my mouth the right way the first time every time. I feel like I'm a little too much inflection, but I haven't practiced it a whole bunch. I do have a call. Are you familiar with those reel calls?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
I do have one of those, and on that you can do it. I mean, it's
okay.
So like it comes out so easy. I want to see if I got one really close here, but I do. Yeah, I do. Let me see. Of course, I'm going to
got one there handy.
Yeah.
Yeah. I do it with my Elk Camper. Is the reed I use. It just seems to have the right tuning and right tension to be able to make the sound.
I don't know. It sounds more vocal when I'm doing it on this microphone, probably because it's vibrating off my head, but it usually works really good on this one. I don't know.
Yeah.
That didn't sound quite as good.
That's it though.
In my headphones. But yeah, yeah, that one seems to be really easy to do because, like, I don't know, it takes the voice inflection real easy without having to put too much
gotcha
behind it.
Yeah, I found when I'm making that sound, I have to kind of be in a relaxed state of mind to where I can breathe deeply and get my air from deep in my stomach instead of shallow, mm-hmm. if you know what I'm saying. There's a big difference. Uh-huh. Yep. If I'm a little keyed up and a little nervous or uneasy about making the sound and my breathing's a little shallow, that's when it doesn't come out well because it's not coming out from deep in my gut, so to speak. That's the big difference maker for me. Like, well, again, a lot of times for me, it's being with a hunter who I feel like instills total confidence in me. Like he believes in me. If I feel like I'm with that kind of guy, I'm more apt to use that sound than the skeptic, if you know what I mean.
Yeah. No, I get it. Yeah. You know, there's a big thing. I put a lot of weight on feeling confident. And as a guide, I think a lot of your confidence comes from not only from yourself, because you have to have your own self-confidence, otherwise who the hell is going to want to go on with you, but
right.
But it also comes from the, like you said, how much this guy believes in you. If you got a guy that's kind of second guessing everything you do, every turn you make, like, it's like, dude, why'd you hire me? Just here you go. Right. You know?
Yeah. Yeah. Do you have your own calls in your pocket?
Let's
hand me the bow. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. No, I know you and I have all, every guide have been in that situation where the client thinks they know more than you, but usually it's the other way around and they're very, you know, they're like,
right.
I paid for you. Let's, you know, until you prove me otherwise, let's do it. You know?
Yes. But,
yeah.
Yeah. I'll even tell guys, John, because you know, some of them have seen the videos or they've seen Elk Camp on TV. And so they can easily have the impression that we go out there and I'm just the Pied Piper and I blow a call and the elk just come running from all corners of the unit. And I tell them, I say, the first thing I want you to know, if you've watched the show, is that, you know, we had to work hard on that episode that you saw to get those, you know, 3 to 5 encounters that you saw on that episode. That took place over a 10-day period or a 13-day period.
Right,
so there were many hunts when we went out when things didn't happen or they didn't come to the call or they weren't bugling. So, you know, I want you to know that we have to work hard for every single one of those quality encounters. And then that way they're typically not so let down when maybe you go out on opening morning and they don't just come charging in from all directions.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. I had that conversation and with my hunter last year, you know, I'm like, have expectation. And he had been hunting elk, I think 2 or 3 times before that and hadn't gotten one yet. So he knew, you know, it was an easy sell. And, man, we had a first 4 days. It was so tough. Well, I mean, I had one bugling, I think opening morning or maybe was that the second morning? I don't remember, but opening morning I had one bugling, and we got fairly close, but we weren't able to make a shot happen. But then after that, it was like, and every afternoon I couldn't pay for a bugle. I couldn't pay for one.
Right.
Every afternoon I could not.
Yeah.
I mean, I started sitting him on water holes and going out, and I would put like an additional 6 or 7 miles on my boots, just going to try to locate elk for the next day, you know,
because
we were wasting time. Like we're wasting time. Like you're better off just hoping something comes into a water. It's dry as hell out here. Let's, you know, get you sat on water and then, I'll go find us elk for the morning. Cause they were only bugling in the morning. And I was like, okay.
Yep.
But yeah. So
yeah, you're totally right, John. I found more and more, especially with these prevalent dry conditions, that the evening hunts are tough. they can be a bust. And if they bugle at all, especially sometimes if it's hot. During that, yeah, sometimes it's during that last 5 minutes of light and you don't have time to get on them. And it can just be super frustrating. You sit out there for 3 hours and nothing happens. And mm-hmm. Just day after day, and all of a sudden you're staring down the end of the hunt and the pressure's on.
So. Yep, exactly. Well, I want to thank you for coming on and sharing your knowledge and your experiences with us. And, going into elk season, I hope everything works out for you and you guys have a great season.
Yeah, same to you, John. I hope so, too. I'm looking forward to it, you know, good or bad. I always enjoy being out in the elk woods.
Same. Thank you.
Learning all the time. And, it was great to be on with you again today, as always. And I appreciate the opportunity. And can't wait to hear your stories when we catch up after the season.
Likewise. Thank you.
Yeah. Thanks again, John.
Bye.
Bye.
Well, that's it for this episode. Thanks for tuning in. Be sure to check out daysinthewild.com. And be sure to give us a review on iTunes. Thank you, and we'll check you out on the next episode.